Today, what do recent election results mean for the future of the Labour Party? And can anything be done to reverse the trend?
Hartlepool will have this morning a Conservative MP for the first time since 1964.
Sitting governments hardly ever make gains like this in office.
Very encouraging set of results so far, and I think that's really because we've been focusing as government on our priorities, people's priorities.
Among all the noise that followed last week's election results, there was one piece that really stood out for me. It looked at a trend in England that we know is underway, the reversal of class politics, and it found a mass of data to prove it. The article in The Observer by Professor Robert Ford didn't just look at Hartlepool, it looked at the results in more than 1,100 council wards. On almost every measure, the Conservatives had done best in the poorest parts of the country, while Labour had performed well in the more prosperous ones. I put that to Guardian columnist John Harris.
Yeah, it looks like a world turned upside down. But only if perhaps if you've got a long enough memory to remember the heyday of two-party politics in the 20th century, when, broadly speaking, the Labour Party was perceived, anyway, as the party of the working class and the Tories were the party of the middle and upper class. It's much, much more complicated than that. But you would not have seen these things coming. If you'd have pitched up in Hartlepool or Stoke-on-Trent or Middlesbrough or any of the places which we now shorthand as being so-called red wall places, 30, 40 years ago, and said, there will come a time when this place has a Tory MP, you would have thought the person you were talking to was mad. Equally, you look at other parts of the electoral map now, you know, the Labour Party got the single biggest vote in Chipping Norton in the Cotswolds in these elections. That's a place that's a byword for David Cameron and Rebecca Brooks and horses and Range Rovers and all that stuff, you know. So things are really, really up in the air and very interesting things are happening.
From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in focus, can the Labour Party survive this political earthquake? John, clearly there are some bright spots in these election results for Labour, but the much bigger narrative is this ongoing and increasingly devastating loss of traditional working class voters, all of which explains the week that followed with a reshuffle that was and then wasn't, and then everyone piling in with a theory of what went wrong, whether it was Peter Mandelson, who says Labour is still too Corbynite.
And it is amazing, because Jeremy Corbyn has not been leader of the Labour Party for, you know, a year. And yet here I was in Hartlepool, having his name, you know, being bandied around on the doorstep, thrown at me.
John McDonnell, who says it isn't radical enough.
So actually the policy programme that we had in December the 19 was reasonably popular, but it needs to be more radical now because...
Andy Burnham, who says the party is too London-centric.
The party's lost an emotional connection with people, and that's strongest in the areas that were previously most loyal to us.
Or even a suggestion by our colleague Josh Halliday that one Labour figure pointed the finger at Angela Rayner's leopard print trousers. Now, apart from the trousers, which I can safely say had nothing to do with the result, how ugly is the mood in the Labour Party?
Well, the Labour Party is pretty good at tearing itself apart. I mean, since I was interested in it in my teens, which is a long time ago, the one thing it's really, really good at is tearing itself apart. So in the wake of a disaster, the left of the Labour Party always says it's got to be more left-wing. The right of the party says it's got to be more right-wing. The trade unions say there ought to be more union influence. The people who don't like the union say there should be less union influence. And a couple of people talk about trousers. You know, between the media, political journalists and politicians, inevitably they work in this world of Westminster, which is very fixated on short-term cycles, who's in, who's out, week by week. And so inevitably the noise is about change the policy, have a reshuffle. The point is that the Labour Party, as its name proves, reached its heyday when it was synonymous with a country that was industrial. It was the party of mass trade unionism, of coal mines and shipyards and steelworks, of the male breadwinner, and of a big state which provided things for people en masse. It was hugely rooted in the country. It was a presence in people's lives. Now, once deindustrialisation happens and all that disappears, it's no great surprise that a party that depended on all that starts to look pretty wobbly. It happens all over Europe, this. It's the same story. You can't carry on pretending that this politics that was conceived for the industrial age is going to be successful in the post-industrial age. It needs new thinking. And that's not something you're going to achieve in a reshuffle. I don't know, maybe a policy review will scratch the surface, but it's very deep stuff, this.
We have changed as a party, but we've not made a strong enough case to the country. We've lost that connection, that trust, and I intend to rebuild that and do whatever is necessary to rebuild that trust.
Keir Starmer says that his party has lost touch with working people. He says he's going to spend the summer getting out there, not having rallies with the faithful, but speaking to people who don't vote for us. John, you've spent years reporting from those communities. What is he going to find?
He'll find a political vacuum, really. In some places, the Labour Party still runs very creative and imaginative local councils, and that gives it a presence in people's lives, and it can insure it to some extent against the things that we're talking about. But in large swathes of, these are all unsatisfactory terms, but in large swathes of post-industrial England, that's not really the case. And the Labour Party has been complacent historically. And I think if you were to say to people in a lot of these places, tell me what the Labour Party did for this place. Now, this might be unfair, right? The Labour Party, whether locally or nationally, may have done all sorts of things for these places. But the most visible aspects as a legacy of Labour rule in these places very often is a horrible, big, brutalist, multi-storey car park that stinks of wee, you know, and looks horrible and surrounded by equally brutalist office blocks that somebody thought it was a good idea to build in the 1970s or 80s. And they, you know, some places, unfortunately, they look like sort of monuments to political failure. That's a great big obstacle to have to surmount. Particularly when the Tory party has like wiped out the last 10 years of political history and has come along saying, oh, we're the people who are going to revive your local airport and bring you jobs and level up, as the phrase goes. You know, whether it's going to deliver on those things at the moment is irrelevant. It feels fresh. It feels like the Conservative Party's going places. So between that collision, really, of this sort of empty history and a past in which the Tory party is sort of free of their baggage, that's why this has started to happen. I think you'll also find people, not all people, but many people, have an idea about the Labour and the left as something in the culture. It's not just about what MPs say or what goes on at Parliament. The left and the Labour Party is something manifested sort of culturally. You know, people mouthing off when they switch on their TVs or people on social media. And I think, with some justification, people, working class people, some, get the sense that the political left doesn't like them. It thinks they're Brexit voting throwbacks, you know. It thinks they're bigots. And the problem is, that might be just somebody on Twitter who's got a few hundred thousand followers who you think was irrelevant to all that. But they switch on a news channel or daytime telly and you'll see those people. And they, you know, they don't like the look of them. And I think that's a really big problem. This is what happens in the midst of polarised politics. And it's very, very difficult to go knocking on someone's door saying, will you vote for me, when they think you hate them.
And how much is that Labour's fault, or how much is it
voices on the left? It's really hard. No, because Keir Starmer has kept away from the sort of polarised politics of the so-called culture wars and all of that stuff. And it's quite difficult in the sense that for someone like me, who's broadly speaking on the liberal left, I understand a lot of that stuff has been the cutting edge of progress. You know, it's entirely right that we have a conversation about institutional racism and the legacy of empire and whatever else it is. It's just that that's one part of this bigger sense in which people feel that they're completely on the other side of a political divide. And, you know, sort of antipathy and hostility flows both ways. And I don't know what a politician can do about that.
On top of that, I got this sense in Hartlepool recently that people were kind of fed up of their town being such a safe seat.
It's sort of rational, isn't it, to stop being a safe seat and turn yourself into a marginal? That's the cleverest move that a place can pull, really. Because for as long as you're a rock-solid safe seat, people don't pay much attention to you. Put yourself in the game politically and become marginal, and everyone starts falling over themselves to spend money there and promise you all sorts of things, right? And I think that's sort of in people's minds, you know. Loyally doing what we were told for 30 years didn't really get us anywhere. So let's throw everything up in the air, and then maybe people will start paying attention.
You know, fascinating is Deborah Mattinson, who's now going in to do strategy for the Labour Party, just written a really good book on the Red Wall.
I know, I've
admitted in the introduction that in all the time that she'd previously worked with Labour, they didn't actually focus group in seats like Hartlepool because they did take them for granted. Now, you've talked about the kind of green shoots for Labour in this electoral map, but if they were to lose more of these traditional heartlands, it would be really devastating for them. There are something like another 24 seats where the Brexit Party did well in 2019. And if a similar trend happens, they could go. And they include MPs like Ed Miliband, like Yvette Cooper, like John Cruddas. I mean, you talk about the long term, but in the short term, is this an existential problem for the Labour Party?
This might turn into an existential problem. If all those Brexit Party votes go to the Conservatives, a lot of places and a lot of MPs are going to be somewhere very politically different. So somebody apocryphally, I think I read somewhere, a Labour insider saying, if we can lose Hartlepool, we can lose anywhere. And I think that probably is what's beginning to sink in here. And I mean, I don't think the Labour Party is going to win the next election. I don't want to read another bit of commentary based on what the Labour Party should do to win the next election, because it's not going to happen. It's certainly not going to win it single-handed. It's not going to have a parliamentary majority. But the chances of having any sort of decent parliamentary numbers at all dwindle even further if that happens to those seats. The other thing is, as you hinted at earlier, I think you can't underestimate the sort of emotional blow here, you know. These places are so central to the Labour Party's understanding of itself and its history and its mission and all that. I think even now it's struggling to cope with all this. It's a hell of a thing, you know. It's like having all your jewellery stolen.
We've talked about Labour decline, but there's a story about the Tory party here as well, isn't there? This is a Tory party that has taken a populist, socially conservative message around Brexit, around immigration, and combined it with an economic policy that has really shifted to the left. It claims to have ended austerity. It's spending or has spent billions subsidising people's wages. But this is a story about them as much as it is about Labour, isn't it?
It totally is. This isn't the 1980s when Mrs. Thatcher arrives and says, look, this is going to hurt, but we've got to do it. And it puts what were then industrial places still to some degree, puts the sort of places we're talking about through sort of 10 years of hell. And in the end, you know, when it comes to Hartlepool and Stoke-on-Trent and wherever else, you know, the Tory party, we don't really care if you vote for us or not because we've got votes piled up elsewhere. It's a very, very different political reality now.
First, the furlough scheme will be extended until the end of September. For employees, there will be no change to the terms.
And I think the pandemic has been central to this, that enforcing some Conservatives to embrace the big state in quote marks and spending money to prop the economy up.
They will continue to receive 80% of their salary for hours not worked until the scheme ends.
It's sort of confirmed this transformation in Conservative politics, which is helped by the fact they've got a leader who'll just, you know, do anything to get elected. Now, somebody like me would say, well, austerity is ongoing. If you look at what's happening to council budgets all over the country, they're still in free fall. But people's perceptions are that the Tory party is sort of generous and mindful of inequality and what it's like to live on the wrong side of a regional divide in a way that it probably hasn't been in recent memory. And that's a huge change. So it's no good for the Labour Party then to knock on someone's door and say, same old Tories, you know, they're just going to, they don't care about you and all the rest of it. That doesn't really resonate.
Now, Boris Johnson obviously realises that this is a route to more electoral success for him. Yesterday, we heard a speech in which he talked more about keeping jobs in the red wall, in which he talked about skills and he talked about the NHS because he knows that they're heading for some trouble with that. How much do you think he's going to be able to consolidate this success?
So there's a question here about the difference between rhetoric and sort of promises and delivery. And again, you know, to make itself feel optimistic and to give itself some comfort, the left says, oh, they won't deliver, right? Now, I don't think they'll deliver as much as they say. And if you look at the amount of money so far devoted to so-called levelling up, it's piffling. But I think some of that stuff will happen. I think the bigger question is about the fact that politics is all about the arrangement of perceptions. And if somewhere's sort of quite close to the bottom anyway and nothing's happened there for years, then even a bit happening is a change and a difference, right? And I think that'll help the government. You know, that's sometimes how politics works. I don't know the answer to these questions. I don't think, you know, the idea that inevitably the Tories won't deliver and the world will be put back the right way up, I think is far too comfortable.
There can be a tendency to interpret this as if it's game over for Labour. You've said yourself you don't think that they can win the next election. But at the same time, the party has done incredibly well in Manchester. It's won in Wales. What lessons can be got from those areas?
So, I mean, obviously, Manchester and Wales, I mean, even talking about Wales en bloc is quite difficult. But in both cases, the Labour Party speaks with an authentic voice. It's done stuff. And I think it speaks to people's sense of place and belonging and who they are. You know, the Welsh Labour Party, although it's not explicitly nationalist, it speaks a sort of benignly nationalistic vocabulary about Wales and why things in Wales are different from England and London, more to the point, you know. Also, Mark Drakeford's had a good pandemic as a leader.
But the great bulk of opinion here in Wales remains attached to powerful devolution, where decisions that only affect people in Wales are only made by people in Wales, but where we continue to be part of a successful United Kingdom. And that's what the Labour Party offered in this election.
And in Manchester, the Labour Party has this long history in the city of Manchester of delivering and regeneration and all the rest of it. And it speaks to people's sense of belonging, who they are. You know, it's got a very specifically Mancunian identity. And Andy Burnham, very skillfully, has made that very vivid over the last year, you know.
Right. So it's going to come into effect on Friday.
The one bit of politics, probably, that people in Manchester have seen vividly was all the drama outside the Bridgewater Hall in Manchester, where Andy Burnham was alleged to have found out on his mobile phone that Manchester was being put in Tier 4 and the Tory government wasn't listening and Manchester deserved better and all the rest of it. And they're really clear, emotional, stirring political themes.
I mean, it's brutal, to be honest, isn't it? This is no way to run the country in a national crisis. It isn't. This is not right. They should not be doing this, grinding people down.
But then also, you've got these other cases in Greater Manchester of councils delivering for people. See, a lot of what we're talking about here is what goes between national politics and people on the ground, right? And in Manchester and Greater Manchester, there is something Labour in that gap, which is that in Wigan, the council has a thing called The Deal, where it very much talks and engages with people about how to turn the town round. In Salford, something similar has happened. In Preston, they've got the so-called Preston model of local procurement, whereby all the council's business, if they can do this, they want it to go to local companies and all the rest of it, right? So it has a story to tell, and it's woven into people's lives in a way which I never felt when I used to go to Stoke-on-Trent or Middlesbrough or those places. I never felt like that. I always felt there was a vacuum there, and there probably still is.
Well, what does Labour do about it then?
Well, clearly there are two levels to being a front-rank Labour politician. You have to do the week-to-week, day-to-day thing of PMQs and policy reviews and who's in the shadow cabinet and all that. That's unavoidable. But what I found, and notwithstanding the fact the pandemic has made the practice of politics very odd, I think one of the main indictments of Starmer, really, is that he doesn't seem to have paid any attention to these much deeper structural long-term things that might take decades to sort out, but they need attention, right? You need some intellectual heft. You need to bring in some thinkers. You need to be seen to say, what's this party? Who's it for? Where's it going?
What is it then? What do they need to do?
What's the Labour Party for? Now, as much as paid work and employment and all that has changed beyond recognition, I think that's still central to the way that people experience their lives and of their sense of, you know, what's going wrong and perhaps what goes right in their lives. So once upon a time, being a coal miner was a pretty horrible, I mean, it always was a pretty horrible job, but, you know, it was a sort of low-paid, insecure job until a political force came along to improve it, give people greater job security, improve their conditions and pay and so on. And then miners became respected and at the top of the labour movement tree, you know. Now, can you do something similar as regards warehousing? Can we talk about how you make care work a more dignified occupation? Can we move beyond a world in which people sit there wondering what shifts they're going to be working next week and therefore whether they can eat or not? You know, and that sort of insecurity is eating into a bigger and bigger share of the population. So I think the Labour Party should bang on about that. One of the most interesting parts of the conversation within the left, certainly globally, is the idea of a Green New Deal and the idea that you can revive manufacturing and bring back quality work in order to tackle climate change. I think the other thing that the Labour Party doesn't go on about enough, I mean, it does, but it's not sort of foregrounded enough, is the fact that we're living in the midst of a huge housing crisis in this country. It falls regionally, but it also falls generationally, and it's a huge, huge thing. So it needs to talk vividly about that stuff. But at the same time, as regards these much longer term historic things, it needs to understand how to refound itself. If there's nothing between the Labour Party nationally and people and their everyday lives, where there used to be the nonconformist church and mass trade unions and these occupations that almost inculcated in people a sort of collectivist mindset, if those things have disappeared, what do you put in the middle? You know, what are your intermediate institutions? Now, there are modern equivalents of those things. Everywhere I go, there are amazing on-the-ground organisations, very woven into the local fabric of life, that in their own small way make society better. Most of them these days, interestingly, are run by women. But they're everywhere, and they have nothing to do with politics. Now, whether you could bring them nearer to politics, I'm not sure. A lot of people who run those things don't really want anything to do with politics. But that idea of involvement in the community and community activism and making politics real to people in the medium to long term will decide whether or not the left renews itself in England or whether it disappears. It's going to take a long, long time for in England for the left and the Labour Party. If it's still the Labour Party, I don't know, you know.
Does it fill you with despair?
No, I don't think it does, because clearly this sort of clapped out old banger of a Labour Party that was tied to these historical things that aren't there anymore. I mean, you could put Go Faster stripes on it for a bit and a new lick of paint and get it a few miles further down the road. But sooner or later, it was always going to shudder to a halt. So I'd much rather have a worthwhile conversation about how to lastingly revive and renew left-wing politics than a silly conversation about how to scrape through it in an election on 35% of the vote or something. I think if you want society to change fundamentally, then you need a much stronger vehicle, pun not intended, than the Labour Party and the Labour movement present at the moment. And that demands a much more honest and sort of thoroughgoing conversation, which, you know, is starting to happen. And the other thing is, there are other things going on electorally which I find really hopeful. You know, there's been a green surge at these local elections. The Green Party has now got as many seats on Bristol City Council as the Labour Party. It's taken seats in Sheffield, you know, in previously sort of so-called affluent middle-class suburbs. The Green Party and the Labour Party, for that matter, have made progress. So there's interesting stuff going on. You know, everything is in flux, and for the left, that has downsides. But if they think hard enough, it might also have upsides. The point is to stop thinking it's the 20th century. It's finished.
Coming up, what might those upsides be for those on the left of British politics? I mean, you talk about the upsides, and there are a couple of big upsides. There were wins in parts of the country that the Tories might once have thought were core Tory areas. And if Labour is able to start to claw back support in the north, then that could start to be a problem for the Conservatives long time, particularly as Labour appeared to be winning with younger people, graduates, people with more liberal views, arguably who might be growing in numbers over time. Do you think in the future that all of this is positive for the Labour Party?
That's the other aspect of everything being in flux. What was the cleverest thing Margaret Thatcher did? Well, as awful as the social consequences of it were, it was allowing people to buy their council houses, because it gave people a stake, the idea that they were property owners and an identity with Conservative politics, right? What's the cleverest thing the Labour Party did in the last 30 years? Tony Blair moving to ensure that 50% of people went to university. It's a statistical fact that if you go to university, you are massively more likely to emerge from that experience with liberal left-wing values than if you didn't go, right? And so, over time, as there are more graduates in the population, you would expect to see exactly what we are seeing, which is the popularity of Labour and other parties of the left among sort of people under 30 is historically high. Now, if that endures and people don't do what was historically expected of them, which is to buy a house, turn 40 and go Tory, I don't think that'll happen. Things are going to change. And in fact, they're already changing all around us. There are parts of South Manchester near where I grew up, which when I was growing up there, sort of sociologically, were like sort of Terry and June. There was this idea of suburbia as being somewhere that was very conservative and Tory voting and all about the golf club and washing your car on a Sunday morning. Those places are now about artisan bread and organic food, and doing your bit for the environment. And a lot of them have Labour and Green councillors. Things are changing there, right? So that's the other side of this vision of everything being in flux. Things are changing on the right too. And if I were the Conservatives, I would worry long term about these generational questions. Who are your voters of tomorrow? For all its current suffering and problems, the left has an answer to that. I'm not sure the Tory party does.
You talk about bright spots for Labour and votes won in other parts of the country, but a lot of that could be some way off. And in the meantime, Keir Starmer has to face another red wall by-election in Batley and Spen in Yorkshire. Quite a different seat, but still a fairly small majority over the Tories. In the Queen's speech, we found out that the Prime Minister is also going to repeal the Fixed Term Parliament Act, which means Labour could be facing an early general election. And beyond any of that, if Labour were to go with these demographic trends and let go of those working-class communities, it kind of wouldn't be Labour anymore, would it?
I don't think so. You know, I perceive Labour as a party which has a, I don't know what the word is really, is certainly rooted in places that used to be industrial. Now, the problem is the used to be, right? We're talking about a past, but I personally am very attached to that. You know, my grandfather was a South Wales coal miner. I was raised in a Labour household precisely because, you know, of those working class values, which I associate with those places. And the Labour Party, without a relationship to those places, feels very strange. The other thing is, if you're on the left of politics, you profess to be motivated by the idea of reducing inequality, getting rid of poverty, you know, ending social exclusion, a sort of fairer and more equal country. Now, if your politics isn't connected and hasn't got anything to say to places like Hartlepool and Middlesbrough and Stoke-on-Trent and wherever else, these are all places that exhibit exactly the inequality and poverty in some part that you're meant to set yourself against. So it's what gives left politics a lot of its meaning.
John Harris, thank you very much.
Is that okay?
Yeah, but you have to say thank you.
Thank you very much.
That was John Harris, who, with John Domikos, has been making films on this subject for more than a decade. The Anywhere But Westminster series is absolutely brilliant, and the latest episode is out right now. After 2 weeks in Birmingham, where John talked about politics, faith, vaccination, unemployment, community activism, and much more. Do also read John's latest column, Labour's Crisis Comes from the Huge Gap Between Politics and the People. We would also welcome your comments on Twitter. I'm at Anushka Astana. John is at JohnHarris1969. And a big thank you for all your feedback in recent days. Do tell friends about Today in Focus and do rate or review us, especially if you're enjoying what you hear. That is it for today. This episode was produced by Sammy Kent. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Phil Maynard, Archie Bland, and Nicole Jackson. We'll be back tomorrow.